Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, June 22nd, 2013, and I'm Harley Schlanger. I will be your host. Well, we've just come to the end of a most incredible week, one in which the two competing forces globally both moved ahead. On the side of the oligarchy, centered under the domination of the British Empire, we've seen an absolutely escalating commitment to war, with this week the Obama administration announcing that it will provide arms to the so-called rebels, that is, the Anglo-Saudi terrorists in Syria. It was also confirmed in the last 24 hours that the CIA has already been training the rebels since sometime last year. This is something that was generally known but was not publicly admitted before. In the world of finance, they've also moved their agenda ahead, with Federal Reserve Chairman Bernanke announcing this week after the Federal Open Market Committee meeting that they will be continuing with quantitative easing at least until sometime in 2014. Now, Bernanke himself was somewhat back and forth on this. Is he going to taper? Is he going to cut back? And when there was a near collapse of the stock market, he was forced to come forward and say, well, we're not getting rid of it yet. But you can see the fragility and the jitters that dominate world markets. Also this week, the European Union Finance Ministers meeting agreed to a direct funding by the European Stability Mechanism of bankrupt banks. It's not a lot of money, but it's a move toward what they call banking union. And of course, we've also seen the imperial forces, including in front of the U.S. Congress, defending the policy of spying on everyone, even while they deny they're doing it. Now, on our side, we're seeing as well significant motion in our campaign to destroy this empire. There have been allied networks in the institutions that have stepped forward. For example, there is an accelerated motion for Glass-Steagall. There were about three more sponsors this week. But probably most dramatic was a showdown in a committee hearing in the Delaware state legislature. Delaware is a banking state. This is where you have numerous corporate headquarters, and 10 of the 21 senators in the state of Delaware have sponsored a resolution calling for Glass-Steagall. When the hearing took place yesterday, a representative of J.P. Morgan Bank came to argue against the resolution, basically threatening the legislators, saying that if you do this, you might lose jobs in Delaware. So that's an example of how this fight has escalated. I would add that when we talk about the war in Syria, there is a very courageous and lone fighter against it. Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, stood up to both British Prime Minister Cameron and to Obama at the G8 summit. And similarly, in a White House meeting where John Kerry was pushing for the immediate bombing of Syria, Joint Chiefs of Staff General Dempsey basically denounced Kerry in a very clever way, saying that we're not talking about swift boats, we're talking about 700 sorties, that is, air attacks, to do this, and that there's no way that it can be done because there's no exit strategy. And I should add as well that in addition to Edward Snowden, a number of other whistleblowers have come forward this week to expose the U.S. National Security Agency collaboration with the British GCHQ on massive spying operations, which include monitoring over 600 million calls a day and total spying on the Internet. So despite the efforts of these people to go before the Congress and say they're not doing anything, it's all legal, and so on, the fact is more is coming out on this. And I will add, just in conclusion to the overview, that people should look for comments from Lyndon LaRouche today, where he called our attention to the continuing role of the Bush family, which is now in the third generation of support of Nazi depopulation policies. Now, on today's show, we'll be reviewing these events of a global showdown with two leaders of the LaRouche movement in Germany. Rainer Oppel of our Wiesbaden intelligence staff, who has been for many, many years at the core of the intelligence work that's done day by day by our colleagues there. And Tony Kessner is one of the members of what used to be called the LaRouche Youth Movement. And Tony's still relatively youthful, at least compared to Rainer and me. We'll have from Tony especially a report on the events occurring now in Germany regarding the massive flooding in recent weeks, which of course has been made worse by the ongoing economic collapse of that country and the destructive lunatic policies of the Greens. So Rainer and Tony, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Okay, you're both there. I just wanted to make sure. Now, Rainer, I'd like to begin with your assessment of last week's G8 meeting in Northern Ireland, especially with the emphasis on Syria. It appears as though there's no serious unity within the G8 for these measures, even though everyone seemed to pledge to go ahead with it. What's your assessment of it?
Well, the summit again made clear that the G8 is a is an outlived institution. Formerly, it was the G7, the seven of the industrialized nations of the Western world, the transatlantic world, came together in 1975 for the first time, and they consider themselves the leaders of the world, leaders, however, from a monetarist viewpoint. And that has certainly outlived itself. Additional problems come in with the acceptance of Russia as the eighth member, so it has become the G8. But also the G8 is immobile. No unity is actually possible. Although the leaders always say we are united in our view. For example, now they have passed the transatlantic free trade zone, which they have discussed for many years, but also that is not not possible because there is no unity on many questions. As far as the system as such is concerned, the G7 is naturally still united. They want to keep the monetarist financial system, which we know is not possible, and on the way to save the system, there are different ideas, so they are not united. They're disunited also on the question of, for example, Syria and Iran. So it's definitely the case when Vladimir Putin of Russia said when I was in at the G8 summit, I was not alone with my views on Syria. That's certainly true. At least the Germans are not on the Anglo-American line because they do not want to arm the rebels and they do not want war. They do not want the risk of a regional general war erupting out of a Western military intervention in Syria. However,
there also appears to be some problem that Cameron's having pushing this through in the United Kingdom.
Yes, there is opposition. Fortunately, there is opposition. There's opposition on many points on British policy, especially on the Syria problem. So he, David Cameron, the Prime Minister, has met strong opposition, not only from the part of the traditional anti-war currents, but he has met strong opposition just recently from the side of the, ironically, the extreme right wing of the Tory party, so for which stands the figure of Boris Johnson. He's the mayor of London. And he's one of those Tory right-wingers who has come out against arming the rebels. So that naturally is an influential wing within the Tories because it overlaps also with opposition to the European Union policies.
Isn't there also opposition coming from sections of the British military?
Yes, there's discussion about the risks and naturally the risks involve that the British military, well, the British leadership may, Prime Minister may have many ideas, his Defense Minister and the Foreign Minister may have many ideas about interventions. However, the British military does not have the muscle to do so, so they always rely on the Americans. If the Americans hesitate And this is the case, as you described, with the Chief of Staff Dempsey, General Dempsey. Then the Brits cannot do very much. That's a fact of history and a fact of presence. So that has prevented intervention.
Now, you mentioned that there's some opposition as well in Germany. I know the Germans have refused to participate in arming. What's the general sense? I mean, is there a sense in among the political layers in Germany that it would be crazy to go into Syria, or are they just cautious?
Well, it's both. The Germans are cautious anyway in terms of military interventions, but they have been involved in several of these, like in Afghanistan, for example. But concerning Syria, many people also believe it would be crazy, especially if you don't know what you get in exchange for Assad. They may not like Assad, the present leader of Syria, but they don't know who comes next. They see that the opposition is disunited. They see the chaos that has developed in Libya and in Egypt, for example, and they are very concerned about the future of more instability in Syria than at the present. The Germans, however, have one problem. They say, we dislike it, we don't want intervention, but we are not in a position to stop intervention. So at a recent European Union summit, this was the official position of the German government, saying that we don't want the rebels to be armed, but we see no way of preventing France and Britain from arming the rebels. That's a problem. Naturally, the Russian position is much stronger against intervention, also because the Russians have a separate and independent Syria policy. And immediately after the G8 summit, the foreign ministry in Moscow made public that there are many dissenting views concerning Syria and Iran, and they want to make it public with a separate statement.
Now, let me ask you another question that has to do with Germany, because there are many people from Turkey who live in Germany and work in Germany, and I understand one of the members of the European Parliament from Germany spoke out very strongly against the repression by President Erdogan against the people who were opposing his regime. Can you say something about that, where we now see what started as a fight over a park, that we're seeing splits in the ruling party in Turkey, and a lot of this has to do with the Turkish government's support of this Anglo-Saudi attack against President Assad of Syria. Is there much of a sense of reaction to that within Germany that you've picked up?
Well, the government of Germany made it public that they profoundly disagree with the crackdown that Erdogan had against the protesters. So here we have Foreign Minister Guido Westerwelle of Germany saying that it's a sign of crisis if a leadership begins to suppress the youth, because the youth has a first right of all to protest. Ironically, he would not make the same statement, or he has not made the same statement in respect to other governments in Europe, Greece, Portugal, Spain, which have cracked down on young protesters. But the statement stands as such and has led to to immense irritation in Ankara, in the capital of Turkey, where the government complained about the German government. Now, as for the Turkish community in Germany, which is about 2.5 million people, in spite of all nationalist or chauvinistic pseudo-Ottoman rhetoric coming from Turkey, only rather few Turks have returned to their country. Most prefer, for good reason, to stay in Germany, because after all, in spite of certain discriminations, which are certainly still here, among Germans against the Turks, that they feel more at home here in Germany than in Turkey. And from that, you have a lot of dissent and discontent with Turkish policies. People see very clearly that that if Turkey continues to walk that road, the Turks will be pulled into a war, and they don't want that. So,
and that was my next question, because what we're talking about in terms of Syria and in terms of the Russian very firm stand in defense of national sovereignty against, in particular, the British and the Obama administration insisting on the right to intervene over and above sovereign nations, which, of course, is also what we see with the European Union. Is there a sense of concern and fear that what we're seeing in Syria, in Egypt, in Afghanistan, Iraq, that there is a danger of a regional war that could blow up into World War III?
I mean, one thing I probably want to mention, Holly, is that there, in the last couple of weeks, I had a couple of meetings with people from the political layer here in Germany, and there's a total lack of strategic thinking, because most people, when they're thinking about this conflict, they don't think about that when Africa blows up, the U.S. AFRICOM is sitting in Germany. So Germany, in the case that would develop anything, would be directly involved, and by Germany as a very strong nation in the European Union, the whole European Union would be involved in this conflict. And it's more so true for the whole Syria conflict. If you think about the attacks a couple of weeks ago from Israel on Syria, in the case Syria would have attacked Israel back, Israel is not under the direction of the U.S. CENTCOM, but under the direction of the U.S. OICOM, which also sits in Germany. So the direct responsibility for a conflict of any nation with with Israel would be Germany, and therefore the whole European Union in connection with the German decision. So you can see, like, everything that's right now around the Syria conflict could very easily blow up in the direction of Israel, and then you have the involvement of the European Union, Germany, the United States, and then what were going on.
But Tony, you're saying that there's not a serious strategic reflection of that reality in the people you're meeting with.
I mean, there are some people that are so-called experts. I mean, you have in the parliamentary system, you have your parliamentarian that are experts for several layers. There are some of them that are very, very concerned, and they say directly to me and to other of our members that that could lead to a World War III, that would lead to a situation where normal civilians being the targets in this conflict, but the broad layer of politics has no clue about that, because they are not caring about the strategic political situation. Like, we have election campaign year in Germany, so they're all in their election campaigns, and nobody thinks about the broader strategic picture.
Now, you're listening to The LaRouche Show. Today is June 22nd, 2013, and I'm discussing the situation globally with two members of the LaRouche movement in Germany, Rainer Oppel and Tony Kessner. Rainer, let me get to another issue, and I think this is something Tony might have something to say about also, which is after the G8 summit, President Obama went to Germany, and apparently there was some tension over the NSA spying issue and so on, and then Obama gave a pretty incredibly inane speech on the reduction of nuclear weapons. What do you make of the whole trip to Germany and the Obama-Merkel relationship? Rainer?
Well, the timing of the trip is naturally interesting, because it was June the 17th, and June the 17th is the day when the Germans and others remember the insurrection against the East German pro-Soviet regime in on June 17, 1953. And that's usually a point of departure for Western politicians to stress the values of NATO and so on, and their commitment to peace and peace and everything around it. But one has to clearly see that compared to the visit 5 years ago when Obama was not yet elected president in Berlin, there were more than 100,000 people gathering. There was euphoria, the first black American president, a new beginning, a new thinking, yes, we can, and all that stuff. And there's certainly some disillusionment because what many people express, if you talk to them directly, is that they are a bit confused that that a president that has received the Peace Nobel Prize when he was hardly sworn in, or not yet even sworn in, that he has been engaged in a couple of military actions and real wars, and that not much has changed from the Bush administration. Now we have the additional problems with the NSA spying affair.
Well, Reiner, on that, this is interesting to me because Merkel is from Eastern Germany, and of course, the spy state par excellence in the Cold War was East Germany with the Stasi. I've seen figures that said one out of every three people had some relationship with the secret police. Does this have a particular resonance in Germany, the fear that something like this is going on in the United States and Britain?
Well, certainly the memory of that is bigger in East Germany, where people really suffered from it. So, but it's interesting to see that while the mainstream press is still hesitant to attack Obama, they only do so if the Washington Times, the Washington Post, and the New York Times do so. They follow a few days after that. In contrast to that, Der Spiegel, which is Germany's leading weekly, welcomed Obama as a big brother, in reference to that famous novel by George Orwell.
They said 1984, exactly.
Yes, the espionage affair, the other affair, Abu Ghraib, and all that has eaten the image of that president. And he leaves the image of being a totalitarian, although he may be a soft totalitarian ruler, but still soft totalitarianism is totalitarianism, quite a harsh attack, and so far unprecedented outside of publications of the LaRouche organization and a handful of other traditional leftists. So this is certainly indicative that certain people think about the situation. I've also seen in meetings and discussions with people of the administration in Berlin that they are quite aware of the problems that Obama is confronted with. Some people know there is the threat of impeachment. This is never discussed in public in Germany, but some people know about it, and so when he came to Berlin, I think the reception was rather sober. You may also deduct that from the fact that whereas, as I mentioned, in 2008 there were more than 100,000 people gathering in quite some euphoria, this time there were only 4,000 people selected guests at an event at Brandenburg Gate. One has to add, this is a high security area. The American embassy to Germany is right next to it. And but there were only 4,000 people, so they would not run the risk of having more people gathering for listening to Obama, because there might have been protests. There were protests in Berlin. There were actions, so that just indicates that Obama's popularity is a thing of the past. And what you will see is that as soon as this impeachment drive against Obama will intensify in the United States, with the respective mainstream U.S. press coverage, then things will also switch in Germany, as they did when Nixon got into the Watergate process.
So Tony, what about with young people? Is there a shift going on? Because I know that the young people in Germany initially fell for the idea of Obama as the great new kind of leader, cool, and calm, and new generation. Has that changed?
Yeah, I think it's again the question of strategic thinking. I mean, one thing I can say for sure that whoever here in Europe or on the other side of the Atlantic in the U.S. will have the courage to stand up against Obama will have the support of the minority of the young people in Europe, because you have a big group of the young people. I would say like probably around 80% of the young people doing campaigns for the last 5 years against all this observation by the states, mainly about the cameras that are put up all over the cities and so on and so forth. So now with the situation of the NSA scandal and today with the publication of all this spying by the British government that was even more than the US government, I think people are pretty much de-illusionized.
Disillusioned.
Yeah, about Obama. But on the other side, you have the big problem in politics that nobody has the courage to stand up against him, or basically they would probably have the courage to stand up against him, but not against the guys that financing Obama and the current system. And that's the biggest problem. So on the one side, people could get support from the population if they would have the courage to address this issue, because most people don't like to be observed by this means. But on the other side, they don't want to break with the current system, and that's the biggest problem.
Well, you know, one of the problems we have in the United States is that if you start talking about the controllers of Obama, there are a lot of people who don't like Obama, but they think it's Obama who's running all these things. And so when we bring up the role of the British Empire, and particularly the Queen and her control over the environmentalist movement as an explicitly fascist depopulation movement, you know, people initially start rolling their eyes, although I think that's shifting a little bit. Tony, what happens when you talk to people on the streets and in the organizing in Germany and you say, look, the problem is the British Empire. It's not an American empire. The U.S. has been taken over by this British Empire. What kind of reaction do you get?
I mean, it depends a little bit on on who you have in front of you. I mean, in general, the German population that have their roots not in Germany, they all say, yeah, we know it's the British Empire. I mean, people that coming from Arabic nations, they know it. I mean, even people you meet from Israel, they say, yeah, we know that there was something called the British Empire, and that's pretty rotten. If you speak to Germans, it's still a little bit difficult, but more and more people get aware that most of the laws in the European Union and also a lot of the financial discussions that are currently flowing around, they are centered around the City of London, and if people come from the City of London, I mean, most of our national banks, the so-called Landesbanken, they're having their main headquarters not in Germany, but in the City of London. So there is a growing awareness, and I think it's more that people are scared and they don't want to think so big. But if you take the time and you bring it up to people, they certainly start recognizing that and they say, yeah, it's true.
Well, I want to get back to this EU question, the European Union, and have a question for you, Reiner, on the finance ministers' meeting. You and I talked about this briefly before the program, and I've seen in the U.S. press making somewhat of a big deal around this decision to have direct bailouts of banks now instead of states through the EMS as part of a banking union. But what exactly did they agree to, and what's the significance of this?
Well, the significance is, first of all, that it's illegal in the sense that the existing EU treaties still speak of a no bailout policies, which we know has been violated for at least 3 or 4 years now by all European Eurozone governments. But it's also legal, everything concerning the ESM, the European Stability Mechanism, which is a nice word for for a bailout agency. The ESM is illegal because it's there's still a case going on against eight different cases going on against the ESM at the Constitutional Court of Germany on grounds that it it's against the German Constitution, various articles of the German Constitution. And we just a week ago had a hearing, 2 days of hearing at the Constitutional Court of Germany. So the court last autumn unfortunately gave the preliminary go-ahead for the ESM, but the ESM is still kept on hold. It was kept on hold until past Thursday when the finance ministers of the 17 Eurozone member countries agreed that the ESM should go ahead in giving money directly to the banks, bypassing the governments and the parliaments. So it just makes a point which was addressed in this late May memorandum of J.P. Morgan Chase, that which said that the European integration would be possible if there were not this obstacle of the existing constitutions in the European nations, which all are based on the experience with fascism. They are anti-fascist constitutions, they are socialist, and they are no good. They are an obstacle to the things that must be done to integrate Europe. Integrate Europe is also a nice term for building the financial empire that is giving away with national sovereignty and democratic control.
This is an interesting point that goes back to what Lynn was talking about today, Mr. LaRouche, when he said that you've got to look at the Bush family and its role in promoting fascism along with the City of London in the 1930s. Depopulation policy and explicit support for Hitler. You see the same kind of thing reflected in this J.P. Morgan memo that attacked the constitutions that were drafted after World War II to protect against future encroachments by fascists. And now we see it coming from the official institutions in the European Union, precisely pushing these fascist policies. So it really is a sort of an example of history repeating itself.
Yeah, the constitutions are still on paper, but the institutions are no longer caring about it. So, and that's the issue at the Constitutional Court of Germany. There have been cases before making the key point that either, although for once and for all, the Constitutional Court of Germany must stop this, what's going on. It was said a week ago, we don't no longer need these yes, but decisions, but we need a clear no. A red line must be drawn against the further attempts to strip us of national sovereignty and democratic control. And here you have the European finance ministers meeting 3 days after these hearings at the Constitutional Court last week and decide we just don't pay any attention to the parliaments and governments. We just give the ESM the power to give money directly to the bank. They start with a modest 60 billion euros, which is really not much money, as we have seen in the recent years, for what is needed for a real bailout. But it's the beginning of something which is naturally very catastrophic and dramatic.
Well, Reiner,
just interesting. I want to lead over to another issue, which is certainly becoming prominent in the German election campaign, which is the situation after the big floods in Germany. So here, the government and the institutions have certain problems gathering 8 billion euros, what they say it was necessary for the reconstruction after the flood. You have to compare that to the easiness with which the German finance ministers gave his okay for these 60 billion euros for the ESM and many more billions for the banks. So I think that will become an issue. You have.
I want to get to the flooding in just a moment, but you actually anticipated another question of mine, which is that in the past, while there's been opposition cases before the Constitutional Court in Karlsruhe, other kinds of forms of opposition, the group of economists speaking out, it seems that the only organized political serious opposition inside Germany is that of Helge Sepp LaRouche and the BUSO, the political organization of the LaRouche movement there. Is any of this registering yet with the... I mean, it looks like there's an election. The elections are what, in September, the elections for chancellor?
Yeah.
Do you know, are we going to have candidates in that election, and is there anybody else who's prepared yet to break with this consensus?
I mean, probably I can say something to that. I mean, I think first of all, we should recognize a warning that came from a resistance group during World War II that you, the time you were referring to, and that said, everybody gets the government that they accept it. But, and that's the biggest problem in Germany. And I also think to a certain degree in the U.S., and it's beginning to change, where people are very interested in Germany about it. And it has a lot to do with acceptance. And the only way you can change acceptance is by changing the paradigm that people are thinking in. And that's the biggest issue. And also, if you're looking at the recent paper by Mr. LaRouche that addresses pretty much the question of human creativity, that's the key thing to discuss. And that's what we, especially in the election campaign, and we're having candidates, and we had recently a whole bunch of meetings here where we addressed exactly that issue. And that changed people, where people said, hey, I want to have meetings with you. Let's do something together, where people organize their friends to make like little home meetings to get them being more involved. But still, it's a lot of things to do. And I think it's mainly depending on the situation right now in the U.S. and the fight around Glass-Steagall, because all the openings that you got in the recent weeks in the U.S. with the House of Representatives, with the Senate, was immediately felt in Germany by much more open discussions with politicians, with on the local level, on the state level, even with scientists, that got more open because they thought that there's something changing in the U.S. And I think that in a certain sense, the U.S. situation determines pretty much what will happen in the German elections.
Well, I think one of the things that Mr. LaRouche's most recent paper points to is that the question, when you have a population that is denying reality or just passively accepting a reality which they know is no good, the issue is not what they think, but how they think. And that's what we're addressing now, and that's what we're addressing on both sides of the Atlantic, and that's the only way you can move people. And on this, I had a follow-up question to what you just said, Tony, about the younger people. You know, we hear of 50 to 60% unemployment of youth in countries like Greece and Spain, growing unemployment in Italy. What's the situation today with youth in Germany? What level of unemployment is there? Is there a sense of despair? And also, is there a recognition that what's happening in Greece and Spain could happen in Germany?
I mean, it could happen any day, so to speak, what happened in Greece, Cyprus, and in other nations. I think the biggest point is that there's a lot of intention to cover up the real situation in Germany. I mean, there is youth unemployment, of course. I mean, people having in Germany an average of 3 years apprenticeship if they want to work in a firm and so on and so forth. And there's a lot of firms then in the middle of their apprenticeship going bankrupt, and then they have to start all over again. And then you can ask yourself, after how many lost apprenticeships, you start getting pessimistic and saying, I don't know if it's useful to work at all. I mean, you're having this situation. You have more and more people. There was recently a report made by the state where every third child in the capital of Germany, Berlin, is considered to be poor. But you don't see them because soup kitchens, they are not in front of the main streets or the shopping streets. They are like in the backyards, and nobody sees how many people are actually there. And also, if you're looking at the reports or just talking to social workers, you have more and more people that getting in a very, very bad cultural state where they're being addicted to all kinds of things, drugs, alcohol, but also pornography, video games, where more and more people sending their kids to psychiatrists because they're saying, like, my kid is playing 18 hours a day video games, don't go to school. I find my 8-year-old son trying to rape his 12-year-old sister. I mean, you're having all the things, so you're having a total collapse of culture, civilization, and so on and so forth. And that, again, is reflected in people telling us, like professors for engineering, they're saying, like, 20 years ago, these people that today passing degrees, there was no way they would have passed their exams. We're having people from the Mittelstand, the small local firms, they're saying, we're getting young people, they are not bad people, but they don't know how to work. They cannot do the same amount of work in the same intensity than previous generations can do. And that's all the things you have to take in consideration. And that means that the collapse can be rather, rather fast.
Well, I think this is also highlighted by the effects of the flooding that Reiner mentioned a moment ago, and I want to get to now, because you see the fact that there's the insurance companies are saying it's about 8 billion euros of damage, which means it's probably twice that much. They just don't want to pay it. But the government of Germany, which is the richest in Europe, offered, I think, only something like, what was it, 100 million? It was a very low figure. And you see this devastation, destruction of transportation, of people losing homes and businesses. Reiner, why don't we start by just getting an update from you on what's happening with the flood situation there. And then I do want to take up the fact that this is related to the years-long campaign of the Greenies, the radical environmentalists, to stop economic development and infrastructure development in Germany. So first of all, what's the situation on the ground right now?
Well, just shortly, as I already indicated, the government thinks in a certain way. As far as the banks are concerned, all kinds of monies are made available at basically no condition, and they never really see to it that the money is being paid back. The taxpayer is led to bleed for the banks. And on the other hand, whether we have a real emergency of the real economy, of the real people that are damaged and are victims of the flood. So here the government is making a big offer of 100 million instant aid, and then they want to mobilize their federal part, which is only 4 billion of the 8 billion we mentioned. This they want to basically give out as a loan. So this already happened in 2002 with the last big flood, when they make available the money mostly in terms of loans, which people are still paying back these days when the new flood arrived and ruined their home, their factory, their shop, and the infrastructure. So it's a monetarist approach, and with that you cannot have reconstruction. In addition, you have the problem of the Greens, which I know Tony has worked a lot on in recent days, and I think he can say something about that, the environment, radical environmentalism.
Yeah, to what effect has that made things worse when you have a natural disaster, Tony, the fact that you've got a domination by these radical environmentalists in Germany?
That's a good question. Probably before we go a little bit into it, just for your listeners, I mean, if you take Germany from the landmass, it's just 1/27th of the landmass of the United States, and we only have 1/4 of the population. But despite the fact we have a 7 times higher population density than the U.S. per square mile. So if you're talking about half of the nation being flooded or being, because of heavy rain, having problems, that is a lot of people that suffering under these conditions. In terms of the Greens, I mean, take it again from the recent standpoint of Mistler's paper, from the standpoint of what is man's nature. I mean, you're seeing everything in nature has its own ecological niche, so to speak. And the thing that is, it's wonderful about man is that we have the possibility to make every niche our own niche. We can transform whole nature to our purposes and using that. And what we're seeing with the flood right now is that we didn't do that for the last 30 years. So we created certain infrastructure in the 40s and 50s with water dams and so on and so forth. But at latest, since 89, 90, with the reunification of Germany, we didn't take care of our infrastructure. And not only that we didn't take care of it, we had the green movement that all along the way did everything to sabotage everything useful to take care about infrastructure.
Now, how does this affect, do we see the effect of this? I do have an interesting report I got from our colleague Madeline, who is usually in North Rhine-Westphalia, but she's writing from Stuttgart. And she said in Stuttgart, there's a massive mobilization of private charity through the Catholic Church and elsewhere to raise money for flood victims. And, you know, again, this is very much like this, once the state doesn't function, you do have good people who will intervene, but you do need the state to protect people. You mentioned, Tony, not much has been done since reunification. Where were the problems? I mean, obviously there was a lot of rain, but why was this flood so much worse?
I mean, there's two good examples. I mean, the biggest problem or the biggest issue in Germany is the cross sections of the river. Like, if you take a river, it has, and you take the cross section, that gives you, that gives you the amount of water that can flow through the river. So you're having two things when it rains heavy. First of all, you need rivers that can transport the water very fast away from the rain region. And on the end of the river, you have to have a situation where the rivers can transport these things very fast into the ocean. So one problem we have since the last 30 years, we didn't take care much about our rivers to keep the cross-sections of the rivers as big as they used to be, what leads to a situation when you have a dam and a freshwater dam gets full, it is allowed to release a certain amount of water. Like from one dam, I took up the example, it's technically allowed to release 1.5 cubic meters per second on water. During the rain, they released an average of 0.3 cubic meters per second and a maximum of 1 cubic meter per second during an interval of 10 days.
So it's not enough that being allowed to be released.
Yeah, exactly. The water that's allowed to be released, it's still much lower than what they allowed to release of 1.5 cubic meters per second.
Right.
Still, that led to a big flood. Why? Because the rivers weren't able to transport the water as fast away as they should be, because the cross section of the of the rivers are too small by wood that's growing into the river and so on and so forth. And why is all this wood and stuff there? Because the green says you're not allowed to green it, to get away of it, because it's the natural habitat of all sort of animals. So that's a big problem inland. It becomes a much bigger a problem, if you allow me to use that example, on the end of the Elbe River. It goes directly in the North Sea of Germany. And there, the Greens, for the last 10 years, they're sabotaging everything to get the land clean where the river should flow. So there's right now a lot of trees and a lot of other stuff. So the water cannot pass as fast as it usually does. So at the River Elbe, it leads to a backlash back to the upper parts of the river that, for example, is the case in Magdeburg, it created a flood. So more and more, to have a comparison, we're creating a situation like your bathtub. The water cannot come out, but the water still comes in. And so by the green policy, as I wrote in a recent paper, you really get a situation where Germany more and more becomes a big bathtub where water can come in by heavy rain and so on and so forth, but it cannot get out.
Now, to what extent is this being covered in the German media? Are they just saying this is a natural disaster, there's nothing you can do? Or is there a reaction against the Greeny policy?
No, there's no reaction at all. Actually, the media is right now supporting that Green policy. They're saying we should have a more crowded situation of more trees and more plants on the parts of the rivers that are close to the oceans, where actually the water should get out of the land mass into the ocean. They said that should be much more crowded, should be more dense, that even fewer water can get out. And for the inland, they're proposing big flood areas where the water can even get more into the area and destroy even more land mass. So from the standpoint, it's really crazy. It's just a point that nobody thinks it through. People are so much in this green paradigm that as long as somebody says it's good for the animals, it's good for the plants, everybody says, yes, then we do it.
And Reiner, is this going to put some pressure on the food supply? Because I know some of the areas that are hit are prime agricultural lands.
Well, I think so. That there are reports that in the flooded regions, the basically all crops for the season have been destroyed. The crops that are to come out in the autumn are also destroyed. Cattle has been has been killed. All kinds of things that concern the agriculture of Germany in these regions have been destroyed and have to be rebuilt from scratch. And what's actually criminal is that there's a strong belief in the bureaucracy, but also it has to do with ecologism, that one should not rebuild settlements, farms, and so on in the flooded regions. It's too risky, and it's crazy because it drives the whole situation back 200 years. About 200 years ago, 220 years ago, the River Rhine, which is the biggest in Germany, was unregulated, and the spring floods and the other floods that also happened very often, they flooded the whole big area of Germany. So the landscape was characterized by swamps and not really densely populated. All in all, you can say if you go for this policy, you basically say that Germany is overpopulated, and if you have a country that looks like the greenies and the bureaucrats want to have it, you can probably not have a population of more than 10 million. In a country that now has 80 million people. So you just see the genocidal character of the green policy. So it drives the development back 200 years. And that has big influence in the government, because a personal environmental policy guru, or Rasputin, as you like, of Chancellor Angela Merkel is Joachim Schellnhuber, the head of the Scientific Council for the Global Environment Issues, that's strongly advising the government, especially the Chancellor, on policies. And he personally is one of those that say all the industrialization beginning with a steam engine and the burning of coal is bad, so he wants to drive development back the past 250 years. And he claims that will be good for the world climate. And that basically means, as he said repeatedly, the Earth can just sustain no more than 1 billion people, which means that he doesn't call openly for the elimination of 6 or 7 billion humans, but that's what it boils down to. You just see the very genocidal character of that. And, as I said, for Germany, it means that of the 80 million people, 70 million would have to go just to make way for this green paradise, which the ecologists are dreaming of, with flood regions and no human settlements and no modern agriculture and no traffic and no nothing.
Look, this is very important, because I think, you know, we've had reports on the effect of the Greens in Germany, especially on the getting rid of nuclear power and certain other things. But, you know, this really does demonstrate exactly what Lynn and Helga Zeplerush have been emphasizing, that coming from the highest level of the oligarchy, you have this demand for depopulation. And a significant factor in this is the deployment of the Greens. And what both of you have just described is a perfect illustration that they are absolutely serious about population reduction. And Tony, you said you've written something on this. Is this in the German publications? It seems to me we should get it translated and get it over on the LaRouche PAC website.
Yeah, we did two podcasts on our website, and I wrote now the second article about the whole subject. But I would like to stress the point that you see the insanity. I mean, most people compare the flood that we had right now in Germany with the recent also events in the U.S. with the tornadoes and so on and so forth.
Right.
But the point that people have to understand, if you have a tornado, we can do much about it. If you have a big storm, as recently hit the U.S., there's not much you can do about it. But this flood, it was total unnecessary. That's what people have to understand. I mean, we had cities close to my hometown that was totally flooded in 2002. People lost like almost everything in the inner city. There was 2 meters up the water. It took them 10 years and €500 million investment to rebuild the city. And they now said, we want to do something against the flood. We're doing a flood wall around the whole city. So then they're almost done with the whole flood wall, and then you get a green movement saying, like, no, we don't want to have this flood wall in front of our houses. And they blocked it for a whole year. And that was exactly the area where the water this year comes in and flooded the whole city again. So people lost everything again, like the whole investment over the last 10 years. Forget it. It's silge. It's gone. So people are crying. People just lost everything. They still have credits. They cannot take new credits. You have doctors there, like whole complexes are destroyed again. They said, we don't know where to get the money from. And the only thing that keeps them still working and not committing suicide, you right now have a lot of people that also give psychological support to the people, is that people saying we're having from all over the nation people helping us. I mean, there's a lot from the Catholic Church, young people helping there, people supporting with money. There's other people helping. And that's what gives the people the strength. The government is doing nothing.
Go ahead.
Yeah, the government is just doing nothing. They still say we invest the $8 billion, which is a joke, comparing to the damage that's done, comparing it to the financial aid that's done. If you compare it with the derivative bubble, that's $1.4 trillion. And then the government of Germany says, oh, yeah, we're giving this people $8 billion. And now they're fighting about who's paying for that, the countries or the federal government. It's totally ridiculous. And people are alone there. If you're taking the farming sector, we lost. Currently, that's not the end numbers. There will come a lot of more things in a couple of weeks. We lost 2% of our agricultural land that got flooded or got damaged by the heavy rain. Like 2%, that's quite a lot. That's 335,000 hectares in Germany. People, if you mention you have milk cows, you have to watch at them. They didn't get killed by the flood, but then they're staying in water, and then where the milk comes out probably gets bacterial infected. Then you have to kill 800 cows for nothing, for just having a green policy that's prevented building the infrastructure or taking care of our infrastructure to prevent such things. I mean, it's not the first heavy rain that Germany had.
Well, I was going to say that the obvious point, and again, this is a very crucial picture the two of you have presented here, and I hope we can get it written up to get out in the U.S., because as you mentioned, we have the same problem with Hurricane Sandy, with the tornadoes that recently hit not too far from where I am in Oklahoma. And what's the line that comes out? Well, no one should live on the coastlines. No one should live in the tornado zones. No one should live along rivers like the Mississippi, where the northern Mississippi is flooding, or the Missouri. Pretty soon you come up with the argument, as Schellenhuber and the Queen of England do, no one should live on this earth except a handful of oligarchs and the slaves they need to keep them going. So I thank you very much for this picture, and again, I would encourage you to make sure that we get it written up for the Executive Intelligence Review and for the LaRouche PAC website, because this is really quite a picture, and I'll talk to my friends over at LaRouche PAC to maybe interview one of you to see if we can get something up on this. Now we've pretty much run out of time, and there are a number of other things I would have liked to have gone into, but for lack of time, we won't be able to. Reiner or Tony, just let me ask you, will we have a candidate in the chancellor's race in September? Is that something we've decided yet?
Yes, we are running. And we are a crucial factor in this election because we are the only party that's still for nuclear power. We are the only party that's still for scientific progress. And we are for aerospace, we are for human creativity. There's no other party like that, so we simply have to be in the election. Unfortunately, we cannot put up candidates everywhere, but we have a couple of state slates for some of the German states, and we have Helga Zeppelrusch as the lead candidate of our party in the election campaign. And she is known, and we are known for addressing the issues in a quite straight manner, using plain language to describe the situation, and that's what our role is, to alert people and to get a rebellion or a repetition of the Second American Revolution, which you have now going on your side, repeated here in Germany, I guess.
And that this time it wins in Europe. This time we succeed in defeating the oligarchy. We're really out of time. I really appreciate having the opportunity to talk to the two of you. Thank you very much for your ideas and insights. And this has been another edition of The LaRouche Show. We'll be back next Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time.